From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all curate images of our lives on social media, posting pictures and messages that make our lives seem better than they really are. But we're less careful on Google, where we search for anything and everything as soon as a question pops into our heads. Things we don't share anywhere or with anyone. A former Google data scientist says those searches reveal who we really are. This hour on Point, Google as digital truth serum. You can join us on air or online. What would your Google search history say about you? Do you find yourself Googling things you wouldn't dare say out loud? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, a warning from CNN's Christiane Amanpour to new graduates about the danger of fake news. But joining me now from Washington is Seth Stevens Davidowitz. He's a former Google data scientist and author of the new book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Seth, thanks for joining us today. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So you call Google searches the most important data set ever collected on the human psyche. Tell us why.
Well, because traditionally, if you want to know what people are doing, you have to ask them. And if you ask people, people tend to lie. But for whatever reason, people feel really comfortable telling the truth to Google. They tell Google things they might not tell friends, family members, surveys, doctors. They might even hide some of this information later from themselves.
Digital truth serum. Google as digital truth serum. Give us an example of this, Steph.
Well, I have many, but one example is if you look at rates of homosexuality, how many men say they're gay in different parts of the United States, you see on Facebook, on social media, or in surveys that there are many, many fewer gay men in parts of the country where it's hard to be gay, so Mississippi and Tennessee. But if you look at Google searches for gay pornography, it's pretty close to even throughout the United States. So a lot of men, I think, in places where it's hard to be gay, don't feel comfortable saying this on social media or to a survey, but do search for gay pornography.
So what is it about Google that makes people feel they can be more honest? Is it just simply the anonymity of it?
I think the anonymity is important. I think there are two reasons. So one is that Google gives you an incentive to tell the truth. So if you need information, you have to kind of tell what information you need. So that's a big thing. If you have an embarrassing health problem, you want to tell that to Google so you can get the information you need. I think another reason, and this is one of the most surprising things I've learned from Google search data, it pretty much shocked me when I started, is people type full sentences into Google. They might type something like, I hate my boss, or I'm sad, or I'm drunk. And it's not really clear why they're telling Google that. I think it's almost like people treat it as a confessional. I think there's something about saying things that you wouldn't tell and you wouldn't say elsewhere that is very cathartic. And people seem to use Google in this way in large numbers.
Well, cathartic, but it also creates a sense of community, right? Because what pops up? Other people who are feeling the same thing.
I think that's right. So, yeah, if you type I'm sad, you're going to get message boards with people who are also sad. And you know, on these anonymous message boards, you can commiserate with them.
You studied aggregate Google search data. The scope of this is mind-bending. How many data points, how many searches are you looking at here?
For an individual search, it's frequently millions, sometimes tens of millions, sometimes even hundreds of millions of searches. So, yeah, the numbers are enormous, and the range of topics that you can study on Google, there's almost no topic, I think, that just about every topic, I think there's some new insights into Google. So in the book, Everybody Lies, I talk about racism and sexuality and child abuse and abortion and anxiety. So pretty much just a whole range of questions. And I argue that there are new insights for just about all of them.
Yeah, I thought the anxiety piece was interesting. What big data showed about where anxiety levels are the highest. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I thought for sure, I mean, if you had asked me where's anxiety highest, I thought New York City, right? Like, I grew up in the New York area. You know, I watched Woody Allen's movies and Larry David. And kind of there's this stereotype of the urban intellectual, neurotic.
Yeah.
If you see the Google search data for anxiety, they're actually highest in Bangor, Maine. Searches for anxiety are highest in Bangor, Maine, and they're higher in upstate New York than New York City. They're actually, on average, much higher in places with lower levels of education, rural areas. Even searches, like very specific searches like anxiety about death, which we think of as kind of the classic Woody Allen intellectual fretting about one's own mortality, those are highest in Arkansas and Louisiana. So I think many of our stereotypes about anxiety are just dead wrong. Hmm.
So how do you determine the accuracy of your studies, Seth? I mean, couldn't people search for some of these things out of curiosity, and then those curiosity searches are being thrown into this aggregate data?
I think the data is not perfect. There are definitely a few curiosity seekers, but these are swamped in the data by people who are really looking for information. And I think one of the reasons we can trust that it's accurate is over and over again, the Google search data correlates with real-world outcomes. So if you look at searches for suicide information, people looking for, really disturbing searches, people looking for, suicidal ideation. Obviously, a lot of some portion of those people are just looking for curiosity, or they may be doctors. But even so, it correlates very strongly with actual suicide rates. In fact, it correlates much stronger than any other data set, such as surveys for that. And this happens over and over again through many, many searches. Even if some of them are for curiosity or for research, they still correlate very, very strongly with real-world outcomes. Mm.
I thought another interesting one from your book was how parents view their children, their sons and their daughters specifically. Tell us what you found based on the Google searches.
Well, we like to think, I think most parents like to think that they treat their sons and daughters the same. But if you aggregate everybody's Google searches and you can compare searches that include the word, the phrase my son, and searches that include the phrase my daughter, and you see that there are noticeable, striking differences where parents are about twice as likely to ask the question, is my son gifted, than is my daughter gifted. And they're about twice as likely to ask, is my daughter overweight than is my son overweight? Mm. And I think, that might be an example where parents might be lying to themselves. They may think they're treating their kids equally, but when we look at everybody's aggregate data, we see on average we're not. And I hope that's one where that information would change the behavior, that a lot of people told me after reading that, that they are going to potentially try to change their attitudes and pay a little more attention to their daughter when their daughter brings home a great report card. Hmm.
Give us another example of what we tell Google that we wouldn't reveal anywhere or to anyone.
Well, there's one example that people reveal on Google that is disturbing is racism. And I've done a lot of research in this area. Where if you ask most Americans these days, are you racist, in a survey, just about every American will say no. It's considered socially unacceptable to be racist. But you see on Google, people make racist searches looking for really racially charged jokes mocking African Americans, and they make these searches in striking frequency. And you see that these searches correlate with a lot of real-world outcomes, such as places that make these racist search in the highest numbers opposed Barack Obama more than other Democratic candidates, and places that make these searches in the highest number supported Donald Trump in the Republican primary. So I think racism against African Americans plays a much bigger role than you'd ever know from asking people.
Can these searches be traced back to you?
No. I don't know anything about any individual. I just know aggregate and anonymous data. So I just know this is how many searches are made, in a given state or in a given city or in a given time period, which is, I think, obviously really important that people's privacy is protected. But we still can do this research and potentially learn a lot about society and potentially, I think, change society using some of this data.
No, in what way? Tell me more about that.
Well, one study I did is on child abuse, and they're actually this is really, really sad. There are a good number of older kids who make searches on Google, such as my dad hit me, or my dad or my mom beats me. And obviously, like, really, really heart-wrenching searches. But it has information that we might not know from any other source. A large percentage of child abuse cases are never reported. So using this aggregate data, child protective services may know not that an individual has committed child abuse, because I think it would be unfair to judge a family based on searches coming from that house. There are too many reasons these could be made. But on aggregate, if these searches are rising in a state or in a city, child protective service agencies should be aware of that they may have a problem or a crisis they weren't aware of.
So that would be you turning your data over to someone somewhere. Is that right?
Yes, that would be, I guess, the anonymous and aggregate data. So you would say to, and I've worked a little bit with some organizations on this. So the organization would just know, the Ohio Child Protective Service Agencies, for example, would know, hey, you know, searches from kids suggesting child abuse have doubled in the last year. You know, you might want to devote extra resources in this area.
I'm curious how you've changed how you use Google because of your research.
I haven't changed it at all because, I think a lot of people when they think about this, you know, they get a little freaked out that personal data is being used for research, but it is all anonymous and aggregate. So for me, it hasn't changed any way that I use Google.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about how Google searches reveal who we really are. You can join the conversation. Does social media make you depressed? Everyone else's best with your inner worst? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's Larry David's daughter, Kazzie, starring in the YouTube series 86th. In this episode, Kazzie plays Remy, a millennial who was just dumped by her boyfriend. After the breakup, Remy's friend tags her in inspirational posts on Facebook, so Remy confronts her about it.
When you tag someone in something, everyone can see, including my ex-boyfriend.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Whatever, you shouldn't care what he thinks.
Well, I care because I'm kind of trying to curate an image of me not caring.
Okay, I'll delete them.
So he probably already saw them, so I'm thinking the best thing for us to do in this situation is for me to tag a bunch of other people in the same post so it looks like you got hacked.
I'm not doing that. People will think I'm crazy.
Trying to create an image of me not caring. I'm talking this hour with New York Times contributing op-ed writer Seth Stevens-Davidowitz. His new book is Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. Let me bring another voice in here from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Ethan Cross. He's director of the Emotion and Self-Control Lab at the University of Michigan. He led one of the first studies that proved Facebook users are unhappy. Ethan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your research, how we compare our inner lives with the curated feeds we see on Facebook.
About 7 or 8 years ago, we got really interested in trying to explore how this relatively novel form of human social interaction, online social media, how it influences people's emotional lives. And what we started doing are a series of studies in which we essentially text message people throughout the day over the course of several days, and we ask them questions like, how do you feel right now? And how much have you used Facebook since the last time we asked you? And a consistent finding has emerged across several studies, which is, the more people report using Facebook, the more their positive mood declines from one moment to the next. So you wake up at 9 a.m., you're feeling really good, you use Facebook a lot, your mood drops down, you then lay off Facebook a little bit, and your positive mood ticks up again. And what we've since been trying to do is figure out what explains that relationship, and the clip that you played captures the phenomenon really well. What we and lots of other people see at this point is that people curate the way they appear online. They portray this glorified self-image, and when we are constantly exposed to the glorified lives of others, but no deep down inside, or maybe not even so deep, what our lives are like. There's a very simple prediction that emerges from that equation, right? You end up feeling more envious, and you feel bad as a result. Mm.
And yet, we are addicted. We're addicted to social media, right? There are algorithms designed to keep us online, to keep us going back. And then positive mood declines based on your research, I guess, is what you're saying, Ethan.
That's right. Addiction's a loaded term. We certainly find ourselves going back over and over. And one question that comes up a lot is, well, if this is leading people to feel bad, why do people keep going on it? And there are likely several explanations for why that is, and this is still a very active area of work. But two explanations that stick out to me are as follows. The first is, we're not always good at predicting how we're going to feel, right? So we may think that going online and seeing what's going on in other people's lives may provide us with a fresh dose of information, not being aware that, oops, that's going to lead me to feel bad. And in fact, there are studies that show that this kind of misprediction happens when people think about how interacting with Facebook and other social media are going to impact them emotionally. The other, and I think this is a really important explanation, is the other reason is that, you know, we are a social species. We have this motivation to connect with others and stay abreast of what's happening in our social communities. And social media allows us to do that really, really well.
Right. It taps into our social anxiety about belonging to a group, right?
Exactly. Yeah. About this need to belong to a group. And so there are competing motivations that we carry with us as we live our lives. We want to belong. We want to feel good. There are lots of things at play here. And so I think you have these different motivations potentially butting up against one another in this space.
I see Richard on Facebook telling us, what I enjoy about Facebook is seeing my family and friends and their lives in a way that would not be physically possible. Otherwise, it doesn't have a negative effect on my happiness. Ethan Cross, is this specific to certain age groups, to certain demographics? You hear Richard's experience there.
Yeah. Well, you know, in our studies, we have tended to focus primarily on young adults, but there have been several recent studies that have looked at these effects, their generalizability across several age groups. There's one large-scale epidemiological study with 30-something thousand people, and the average age was, you know, middle age. 40 and 50-year-olds, and similar effects were observed there. So there's always variability in people's responses. And so what we're talking about in our studies are average levels of responses. Richard, you may be on one side of the bell-shaped curve that characterizes most of the data that we obtain in our experiments.
Seth Stevens-Davidowitz, jump back in here. You hear Ethan Cross talking about the effect of Facebook on our mood, makes it go down, positive mood declines, makes us envious even. Are there parallels for Google searches?
Well, I think Google searches offer a nice contrast. I think, I kind of talked, I wrote a recent New York Times column about this, don't let Facebook make you miserable. That when you've researched enough Google search data, you kind of realize that we're all a mess, and you stop taking people's curated social media profiles too seriously. So I think it offers a striking contrast: people's lives on social media and people's lives on Google. One of the examples I talk about is how people talk about their husbands on social media.
Oh yes, this is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, where the top ways people describe their husband on social media: my husband is awesome, the best, my best friend, so cute and amazing. And on Google, when they type my husband is, awesome is also in the top five. So that checks out. But the other ones are mean, a jerk, gay, and annoying. So it's kind of interesting to compare the two sources. And I say, as far as if you're feeling down, like a new self-help mantra is don't compare your Google searches with other people's Facebook posts.
Ethan Cross, why do people lie on their own profiles? What's your research show?
Well, you know, I think a lie might be, I think...
Okay, bend the truth. Make it look like it really isn't. Yeah.
Well, Well, you know, one thing to keep in mind is we all curate the way that we appear, right? I wake up, I take a shower, I try to, you know, shave without nicking myself, pick a pair of pants that match my shirt, and so forth and so on. We all curate to some extent. It's just that our ability to do so online is really on steroids, if you will. We have this ability to really polish what we're going to say. You know, I could say something to you and screw up my delivery. I can't go back and retrieve that moment in time. Well, you can on these social networks. And I think people are simply taking advantage of that opportunity. Why wouldn't they? You can make the argument. Everyone else is going to see it.
And there's an authenticity about sort of being who you are, you know, warts and all. Right, Seth?
Yeah, there are some people on social media. I think everybody has a few friends on social media who show all their warts. They go the opposite direction.
Yeah.
But I think that's pretty rare. And on average, you know, I've looked at the data and compared how people describe themselves on social media to the real world. And just over and over again, you know, if you compare how many people own BMWs versus cheaper cars, the percentage of people who post about a BMW they own is much, much higher. And the percentage of people who post about reading the Atlantic monthly relative to the National Enquirer is much higher than the people who actually read that.
Much higher. I saw that, too, in your
book.
Yeah. Let's get Diana in here from Palmetto, Florida. Hi, Diana. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I think his study is really, really great as far as social media is concerned. But I personally, when I look at people's posts that are posting lots of stuff about their husbands and how happy they are and, you know, what a great life they have, the first thing I think in my mind is that person is not a very happy person, because I feel I'm a very happy person, but I never post about my husband. I never say anything. I don't excessively post about my kids. You know, it's just, I post about stuff that I, you know, that is about me, that I like, things that are about, you know, things that I would want other people to see.
In a little bit more real way. Yeah. No, Diana, I thank you. I hear you. Ethan Cross, would you respond?
You know, it's interesting you have that reaction. You know, it's hard to know why people, you know, are saying the specific things that they're saying. I do want to suggest, I don't want to leave people thinking that social media is toxic across the board. You know, there are benefits that one can accrue from it. And we recently did a study with people who had major depressive disorder, so clinical depression. And one of the things that's so interesting about people who are clinically depressed is that in everyday life, offline, they tend to get a lot less social support from their networks than people who aren't depressed. And one interpretation of that is, if you're constantly talking about how, you know, sad you are, people don't like to be around you, and they stay away. Well, it turns out that on Facebook, it's the exact opposite. So we scraped the walls of depressed and non-depressed participants in our study for weeks. And what we found when we coded the kinds of responses that people got from their networks, the clinically depressed people actually got a lot more emotional support than the non-depressed people. So, you know, interestingly enough, when we asked the depressed people, did you think you got a lot of support? They rated themselves as getting less support. So they didn't think they were being helped, but actually the help was there. The network was responding. So there are potential benefits, emotional benefits, that are associated with how we interact with the technology. The real challenge is to figure out what are the strategic ways of using it so that you can use it in a way that helps rather than hurts. And that's where I think the contrast to Google is so phenomenally interesting, because you could begin to think about what are the conditions that lead people to be more authentic and honest in a Google search, but not in a Facebook search, and then try to use that info to help us.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Seth Stevens-Davidowitz, jump back in here. Give us another example based on what Ethan just said from your research.
I think one thing that I'm trying, I like the comment of the caller about whether people who are happier, whether people who post pictures of relationships are on average more miserable. It's actually something I'm studying now, but I haven't finished yet. I'm trying to predict whether posting a lot of pictures of unhappy relationship pictures, whether that predicts your relationship's going to last. My hypothesis is the more you post, as the caller said, the more likely you are to divorce. But I haven't finished that.
Goodness. Okay. To be determined. We'll wait on
to be determined. But I do think that in general, you know, the caller talked about how she's very honest on Facebook, and I don't doubt that at all. And there are definitely people who are more less honest, and there are people who don't definitely exaggerate their wealth, who would have no problem posting, you know, a budget car or even that they read the National Enquirer. But I think for everybody, there are certain areas that they don't post about. And I talked about some health conditions, how some embarrassing health conditions have had a much harder time building a community online on Facebook than less embarrassing health conditions. I think there are some things that people don't feel comfortable posting on Facebook. So I think, you know, even among honest people, definitely people have some spots where they don't feel comfortable sharing this information with all their friends.
Here's an NBC News story from 2015. It's a story about social media creating anxiety for adolescents. Here's 14-year-old Patty saying she occasionally worries about seeing her friends posting their activities and their adventures online. It's known as fear of missing out, or FOMA.
Sometimes I do have FOMO because, like, sometimes I won't get invited to something and my friends will start posting it on social media, and then I'll, like, be, like, upset that I wasn't invited.
I hear this all the time from my preteen, Ethan Cross. I mean, this is real, the FOMO, whatever you call it, the fear of missing out.
Yeah, I mean, this is the phenomenon that, it really just captures this vast space of data that we see exploding from all over the place, which suggests when you see about it, when you've got a live stream essentially of all the parties and all the good things, and you can't possibly be at all of them, you can't possibly be invited to all of them, your life can't possibly be that good.
Right.
What's going to happen? You're going to feel bad. And I think that's, you know, we didn't know that when we started this work, and it's been really interesting to discover that. I also don't think that people had any clue that this was one possibility when these social media platforms are being designed, but it's how we've begun to use them, and I think the real question is, what do we do about it?
So tell us what we should know in the minute we have left here, and I know you have to run. Tell us what we should know about good mental health and using social media.
Well, we recently did a large-scale review of the literature, and what we found was that you can bin people's usage of social media into two buckets, if you will. Actively using the technology, so to chat, to share, to comment, and passively using these platforms, so really scrolling through the wall, clicking through people's pictures and things of that sort. And what we find is that there's a consistent negative relationship between the more you use the technology passively, the worse you subsequently feel. That seems to be emerging across the board. Actively using it, so using it to specifically connect with others, to share with them, and so forth, there the effects range from having no implications for how you feel to, in some cases, leading you to feel better. So the quick take-home point is that if you care about how going on Facebook is going to impact you emotionally, don't use it passively, use it actively.
Great information. Ethan Cross, director of the Emotion and Self-Control Lab at the University of Michigan. Great to have you with us, Ethan. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Our Google searches tell us the truth about who we are, the good, bad, and the ugly. We're talking about that this hour, and you can join the conversation. How much thought do you put into what you search? Do you worry your searches are going to come back to haunt you? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a video from the website College Humor, imagining if Google was a person sitting across from you while you ask questions. It plays out how ridiculous the searches sound.
Is today tomorrow New Zealand?
Yes.
Foot same length Europe?
What?
Inch same length Europe.
Gmail.com. What is Bitcoin?
With me this hour from Washington, Seth Stevens-Davidowitz. The new book is Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. And joining me now from Litchfield, England, is Paul Wicks. He's the Vice President of Innovation for Patients Like Me, an organization mentioned in Seth's book that uses data from more than 500,000 people to better inform patients about their conditions. Paul, great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us how Patient Like Me was formed. How does it work?
Well, we were founded in 2004 by Ben and Jamie Haywood after their brother Stephen was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, at the age of just 29. And with their friend Jeff Cole, they launched Patients Like Me as an online community that helps patients to connect with each other, to share their medical data in a scientifically credible way, and to create new knowledge about how to understand, treat, and live better with illness.
And what types of users do you have?
Well, we first launched in ALS and then expanded out to other serious neurological conditions such as MS, Parkinson's, and epilepsy, and expanded out to other conditions like mood disorders and HIV. And then a few years ago, we actually opened up the site so that anybody with any condition or even combination of conditions could join. So today we have members across 2,700 conditions. Most of our members are adults with chronic conditions, and they're really looking for ways to manage their symptoms, their side effects, and to share their data with other people to sort of help other people that might follow them in their journey in the future.
Well, that's interesting. So do people with, say, a common cold or diabetes share in the same way that someone who is terminally ill might share their experience?
So it's really a question of risk versus benefits. And I think in the case of somebody who has a life-limiting illness, they're very motivated to search for information. But also they realize that, they wish for their experience with their illness to really count for something, to mean something. And in a way, sharing your data can actually help others that are living with the disease right now, but also if it contributes to research, then that can help in the fight against the condition they have. Whereas people with, say, a cold or something like that, it might be self-limiting, and so they're less motivated to really enter a lot of data and stick with a program like that over the long term.
A few years ago, you built a community for people with epilepsy, and tell this quick story about how you changed one life.
Yeah, so this is a really important story to me personally, because I spent a lot of time working on the technology that underlies that, and this woman named Letitia had her first seizure when she was just 10 years old, and she'd been struggling with seizures for decades that actually meant she had a serious car accident, so she couldn't drive anymore and she was at risk of great harm. And when she joined Patients Like Me, she learned from other members that there was a type of doctor she'd never heard of before called an epileptologist. And when she found one, it turned out she was a good candidate for surgery, and she saw from other members on the site that people who'd had that had great results, and that gave her the confidence to go ahead. She had the brain surgery in 2012, and she'd been seizure-free ever since. So now she can drive, she's a patient advocate, and just recently she actually paid it forward to a young teenager who found herself in the same position that Letitia had been. So now she's had the surgery, and she's top of her class. So that's really the power of openness and the power of sharing.
The power of sharing is right. Paul Wicks, Vice President of Innovation at Patients Like Me. Really appreciate it. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the phones here. Got a full board full of them. Mary in Boston. Hi. Thanks for waiting, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
We're thinking about something earlier in the conversation here where we were talking about how how could we have predicted people would have used social media this way? What would have been some clues? And I've always felt that Facebook is a lot like the Christmas newsletter, except it's so relentless. It's the Christmas newsletter that never stops. people have always sent these Christmas newsletters that try to really paint their lives in the most perfect way. And now we're dealing with that every day. If we go on Facebook, everyone, we're reading each other's Christmas newsletters nonstop. And I've talked to people of all ages, young people especially, seem to just get really insecure about this. But then older people, like my 89-year-old mom, who's on Facebook now, she gets very confused about why she's not seeing my cousin talking about her child's brain injury. And I'm like, Mom, no one's going to put that on Facebook. Mm. If you want to know how she is, call her up.
Yeah, so the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, yeah. They think they are in relationship, but you're really no more in relationship than you were when you were reading that curated Christmas newsletter. So I feel like we have precedents about these buffers we put up, and we have to constantly be asking ourselves, but what is a real friend? Is it someone on Facebook, or how do I authentically engage with someone? Can I find out if they're sick? I mean, I loved your previous guest creating these specialized communities that where people might be more honest, because I feel like in the very broad community, we're just pretending.
We're not, right. Mary, thank you very much. Appreciate your thoughts. Let's go to another Mary in Tampa. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I'll just start out by saying I'm an Army brat. I've not lived anywhere longer than a year and a half, maybe two, in my entire life. I basically wrote off everybody I ever met, every friend I ever had, because we moved, and I was writing 30 pen pal letters a month.
Are you on Facebook? Are you on Facebook?
I'm on social network. I'm on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, oddly enough, I had all my high school friends from Heidelberg, Germany, find me on Facebook. I had all my high school friends from Balboa High School in Central America, Panama, two separate countries, two separate high schools. And I cannot tell you how significant that was to me. I basically had written that off, a huge part of my life. We have reunions every year. We have Facebook time. We meet. We greet. We share beverages. Everybody's exactly the way they were in high school. Nobody's painting fake pretty pictures, you know.
Yeah, more authentic.
My
yeah.
kid's a pain in the ass. You know, the same things that we were saying when we had FaceTime. And I'll tell you, it's really, really, really changed my life and really helped my heart heal from so many losses and so much trauma, being ripped away from friends, having to say goodbye, on and on and on. So,
So it's good news for you. Yeah, no, I hear you, Mary. Thank you. Thank you very much. Seth Stevens-Davidowitz, jump back in here. There's Mary saying, well, it works for her, at least social media does. Give us another example of what you've been studying as far as social media, as far as Google, and what it tells us about each other.
Yeah, well, I think, I agree with the point that some people, social media does make, it does make them happy. And I also, the previous caller, I like the point about the previous Mary about how this isn't new. I talk about how Alcoholics Anonymous has the famous phrase, don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. So there's always been a contrast between the things that we feel and the ways that other people present themselves on social media. But I do think that in general, it gives a pretty misleading picture of the world, and that we can understand things more by looking at sources like Google searches to understand what's really going on.
From your book, you talk about how Google searches predict violent crimes. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so you can actually see, for example, a lot. So another disturbing element in Google searches, people make some really, really shocking searches. They search things like kill Muslims or I hate Muslims. And these searches actually predict when hate crimes against Muslims will be high, which suggests that police departments may want to incorporate this information. If these searches are tracking high, they may want to put extra security around a mosque. Of course, the other question this raises is, do you track individual searches? What should happen if someone's searching kill Muslims or I hate Muslims? And it kind of brings up, if people are familiar with the movie Minority Report, where people can be arrested before they do anything because algorithms figured out they were likely to commit a crime. So it raises some big ethical and legal issues that a lot of people who are making these dangerous noise online. What do we do with this information?
So, just to be clear, do violent searches are they predictive of violent behavior?
Yeah, so they are on average, but I think a big risk in using this information to at an individual level is that the vast majority of people who make violent searches don't go through with it. So on aggregate, they are predictive that if more people are making these searches, you can bet that crime will be higher. But it's still true that the majority of people who make these searches don't go through with the action.
You talk in your book about cases of pancreatic cancer that could be identified because of Google searches. That was interesting to tell us.
Yeah, so that was a study of de-identified and anonymous searches over time. And they could predict, they could measure that someone likely had just gotten a pancreatic cancer diagnosis. When you're diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I think most people make some search about it. They might search, just got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer or something of that nature. And then what the researchers did is they looked at the symptoms people were making in the months leading up to that diagnosis, the symptoms people were searching. And they found really, really subtle patterns in the data that if you have indigestion followed by abdominal pain, that's a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. And if you have indigestion by itself, that's not a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. So really, really subtle patterns that they could only find because the data set was so large. It almost suggests kind of a revolutionary type of medicine that you could mine the searches people make anonymous and de-identified over time and build models of dangerous symptom patterns for certain diseases.
About 30 seconds left here. You write, Seth, that big data can't solve everything, that people ask you all the time if you can influence the stock market. Tell us about that, why that wouldn't work.
Yeah, well, it's everyone's trying to like see if I can use my expertise to make them rich. But I think it's hard to predict the market for a lot of reasons. One of them is that you're fighting against inside information. So you might have the best model in the world, but someone else might have someone inside a company who has better information, and all your modeling in the world isn't going to beat that. So it is one area where I've struggled. Yeah, I think I've gotten a lot of insights into how the world works with some of this data, but I haven't gotten rich off it yet.
All right. Well, remember your mantra. Don't compare your Google searches with other people's Facebook posts. Okay? Isn't that what you said?
Yeah. Thanks so much, Jen.
All right. Seth Stevens Davidowitz, author of Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Seth, thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate it. Good luck.
Thanks.
In a moment, listeners, we will listen to CNN's Christiane Amanpour. She's going to tell the class of 2017 at Northeastern University here in Boston, beware of fake news. Back in just a couple of seconds with that. This is On Point. Earlier this month, CNN chief international correspondent Christiane Amanpour addressed a crowd of 20,000 at the TD Garden in Boston for Northeastern University's graduation. She spoke about her decades of work as a journalist covering major world events in countries around the world, and specifically of her concern about the rise of fake news today.
Fake news has been a political weapon throughout history. Sometimes it's called propaganda. It is always a war to dominate, distort, and influence the public sphere. And it does so with so much greater effect in our information age. The Russians are masters of this art, of waging war by other means. And I recently read a fascinating report by the BBC when in the early 1980s, the KGB planted news that AIDS in this country was the product of a secret American military experiment right here. The KGB first planted stories that it was actually the CIA that assassinated President Kennedy. The KGB pushed the slogan, Reagan means war, during the 1984 election. And with Russia's interference in the 2016 election here, still under investigation, the real question is, why wouldn't we believe that they're still at it? Ordinary people as well, here and around the world, are jumping on this bandwagon, planting lies that go viral, move the dial, and racking up hundreds of thousands of ad revenue dollars for themselves. The perpetrators are laughing all the way to the bank. One American fake news writer openly told a reporter that people here are too stupid or too impatient to read beyond the headlines, much less to fact check. So you young people need to go forth knowing what you are reading, what you're clicking, what you're watching. You need to know that it matters where you get your news from. I recently read about a book that was published a decade ago. It's called The Cult of the Amateur. And it says, of course, that the internet, when it first burst onto our stratosphere, promised, quote, more truth to more people, more unbiased opinion from dispassionate observers. But in fact, the author says, and this was a decade ago, that it really has delivered superficial observations of the world around us rather than deep analysis, shrill opinion rather than considered judgment. It has turned anybody into a journalist, and it has empowered anybody who chooses to go online, find a site, troll, say what they want, go viral. Our democracies depend on recognizing the difference between truth and lies, because that is also the difference between democracy and dictatorship.
That is CNN chief international correspondent Christian Amanpour addressing Northeastern University graduates earlier this month in Boston. For a video of her address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.